Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
During the early 1800s, something was happening in London, and in fact all over the UK, which would change the face of things forever. The Industrial Revolution was bringing people kicking and screaming into the future, and people were experiencing a brand new way of life that they'd never encountered before. The world was changing at a rapid rate. Factory working became the norm for the majority of people, and as this was the first time this had ever happened, there seemingly were no rules. The machines, and more importantly, those who had created them, began to take over, and working class rights were non-existent. Women in particular had realised this decision to not allow them to vote meant they were being continually downtrodden and their rights were non-existent. They had no rights of divorce or birth control and they were paid much less than their male counterparts. This universal message from the government was heard loud and clear that 50% of the population were expected to do the lion's share of everything and yet weren't afforded the respect, safety, and importance of their male counterparts. Enough was enough, and if women wanted to be heard, they would have to use deeds, not words. Today on Macabre London, we uncover the story behind the formation of the suffragettes. And welcome back to another episode of Macabre London. I'm Nikki Druce, your host with the silent G, and today I'll be taking you on a journey down another of London's grimy backstreets to uncover a macabre tale from the city's past. And today we're picking back up with part two in our series about the suffragettes and finding out about the battle which changed the course of the campaign. But first, if you're new here and you want to see more videos where we deep dive into historic tales from London's past and sometimes all over the world, then please don't forget to subscribe or follow so you never miss a new episode. If you like what I make and you have done for a while now, I have a Patreon where you can get more of the show. There's my extra show on Patreon called Having a Problem, which is lots of silly fun with a bit of history thrown in, and I just posted an update about what's coming up this year on the show over there too, if you want to check it out. I'd love to see you over there. It really is the best way to support what I make to make sure the show can continue, and why not take a look on patreon.com/macabre London. We pick up today where we left off in Manchester. The Peterloo Massacre had just happened. People were dismayed at the way they had been treated, and many people sat in prison for their supposed crimes against the government. After Peterloo and campaigning for universal suffrage, people were beginning to see that the government were very happy with how things were and had no intention of changing things. In Parliament, the system was working to make sure those that had wealth had power. The way voting had been allowed so far was incredibly unfair and actually only represented the views of a tiny portion of the population. From 1800 to 1830, the population of the UK had increased by 50%, and in 1831, only 4,500 men could vote in parliamentary elections, meaning less than 0.5% of the population had the right to vote. Parliamentary representation was heavily skewed. Rotten boroughs, who had an exorbitant amount of representation for their few residents, were incredibly corrupt. For example, in 1831, Dunwich in Suffolk, a tiny village with just a population of 32 people, could elect two MPs. All the while, whole cities like Birmingham and Manchester had no representation at all, as they didn't have a Member of Parliament. This failure to give these large cities any parliamentary power meant everything was being decided with no input from people that actually had experience of what it was like to live in those places. This meant life was awful, the mortality rate had shot through the roof, simple diseases which were down to unfit living conditions ran rife, such as cholera, and big cities were failing. With increased pressure for electoral reform, and more importantly the workforce they relied on to make the money dropping dead, Parliament inevitably had to give in to make the much-needed changes. However, they would do this in the leanest way possible. The Great Reform Act of 1832 was a compromise. It was a performative act which, actually despite its name, didn't really make any changes, and the title was definitely performative. The Great Reform Act wasn't actually all that great. With mounting pressure from working class people, the government could see that ripples were starting to spread and civil unrest was mounting. If reform did not take place, then it was highly likely a revolution would be activated. It only took a little look at the other areas of the world where similar battles were happening to realise it wouldn't take long for the fit and healthy to rise up. England had seen this before. The Peasants' Revolt of 1381 was enacted for similar reasons, and in that, many figureheads had died at the hands of the serfs. France had just gone through their second revolution in July 1830, when voting rights were changed, and what with the general public now being mainly literate, the word had spread. The divide was growing larger, and with ideas in their heads, the general public would have to fight. Petitions were falling at the Prime Minister's feet every single day from major cities and towns asking for reform. And yet, despite the Great Reform Act of 1832 title, this legislation didn't actually represent them at all, and their votes still wouldn't be allowed. The vote wasn't awarded to working class men, and instead was written in such a way that in all reality, only middle class men and up would be allowed to vote, as who was allowed to do so was restricted by property qualifications, something the working classes couldn't afford. This blatant disregard for the men and women who were driving the country along strangely didn't have the calming effect the government were expecting. They were still trying to maintain the ultimate power. The living conditions in the UK at this time are recorded as being some of the worst in the world, and the quality of life was horrendous for the majority of people. No one was guaranteed the safety of tomorrow, and the mortality rate was shocking. This grim way of life was disheartening, and it seemed all hope was lost. These men and women had been pushed to their limit, and now the anger was starting to boil over. These people weren't afraid of death. It was in their homes, in the air they breathed, the water they drank, the workplaces which paid them next to nothing for 16-hour days. The government had picked a fight with the people that gave the cities their heartbeat, They pulled the rug out from under them, just as they thought things would change for the better, and the bitter resentment was growing like pus inside an infected boil. It was only a matter of time before it would burst and infect the rest of the country. Suffrage groups popped up everywhere to fight this unfair action. Men's groups for universal manhood suffrage were created. The Chartist movement, consisting of mainly working class men, was developed. Their 1838 People's Charter was created by the London Working Men's Association. This petition was clear and to the point, with six key demands: universal suffrage, the secret ballot, annual parliamentary elections, no property qualifications, equal voting districts, payment of members of parliament. This clear list of demands was extended several times to Parliament, but was rejected at every attempt. As time ticked on, in the 1840s and 50s, this continual rejection of rights created civil unrest. MPs and elections were now being demonstrated against, members of Parliament were often pelted with rocks and bricks, and the police frequently instigated riots with protesters just for the simple fact they could then arrest them. The strikes had worked to send a clear message, which was shouted loud by the workers, and this set off a series of general strikes across the land in 1842. Workers forcibly broke machinery, hid vital parts of mechanisms, and stole plugs so steam boilers couldn't be filled. This final act gave the general strike the name of the Plug Riots. These protests were met with harsh action by the police and armed forces. Thousands of people were arrested and sent to trial, and many died. In a strike at Preston, four men were shot at and killed by the Rifle Brigade, who decided to open fire on the static crowd. Two men who also sustained gunshot wounds had to have their limbs amputated as a result of their injuries. On another picket line in Halifax, six people were killed, and the result of the riots was again a tightening of the laws. It seemed every time the common man tried to speak out for themselves, the screw was tightened. The consequences of the plug riots was felt everywhere, and yet again, the resistance to progress by the government was heard across the land, with the universal punishment being dished out to everyone. By this time, people had been fighting for universal suffrage for almost 50 years. They were exhausted by the system which was destroying them all. The hope was dying and the system was winning. This one-sided battle was proving to be unconquerable. With one last push in 1848, the Chartists submitted their third and final petition, which was once more rejected by Parliament. This defeat was enough for the movement, and they disbanded soon after. It seemed the government had indeed won.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
However, not all hope was lost. Suffrage groups with younger members began popping up. MPs were turning over in Parliament, and fresh blood was replacing the Regency men who had been in their position of power for decades. With this fresh blood came new ideas, new ways of thinking, sympathies for the downtrodden working classes, and a breath of fresh air in the stuffy rooms of the cabinet. By the mid-1860s, the fight for universal suffrage was back on, And whereas in the past, only limited progress had been made, with some new faces inside Parliament, finally discussions were able to be initially had. MP John Stuart Mill had found his way into Parliament, and he actually had a very interesting view on life, unlike other MPs, and he recognised that his privileged position of power could be used for good. John Mill was a utilitarian. This way of thinking is something which still holds up. To distill it down to its very basics, it prescribes actions that deliver happiness and increase overall well-being for everyone. This in turn creates a society which lives their lives in a way which ensures the greatest good for the entire population. Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, who nowadays is arguably better known for his auto icon, or taxidermied body, which sits in the University College London Student Centre foyer, described the philosophy as the property in any object whereby it tends to produce benefit, advantage, pleasure, good or happiness, or to prevent the happening of mischief, pain, evil, or unhappiness to the party whose interest is considered. Bentham died in 1832, but his teachings were brought into Parliament by John Mill. With his utilitarian lifestyle at the forefront of his mind, he was the first to float the idea of women's suffrage being a good thing in Parliament. He asked campaigning women to draw up a petition and said if they could get 100 names on the list, he would present it to Parliament as a credible request. Now, of course, these women being highly motivated and organised, it took them no time at all to get to 100 names. Millicent Fawcett, who was a supporter of the suffragists and had been from an early age, was put in charge of distributing the petition despite not being old enough themselves to sign it. 18-year-old Millicent was lucky enough to be very well educated. She spoke eloquently and her writing skills were exemplary. It was down to her keen ability to be able to communicate the importance of the petition, and she did so with crystal clear accuracy, which enabled her to expedite the amount of signatures upon it. Other prominent Victorian women also pushed the petition, including Millicent's older sister, Elizabeth Garrett. Elizabeth was the first woman to qualify as a doctor and surgeon in England and was responsible for paving the way for women in medicine. Millicent was picked by John Mill to lead on the petition as they'd met a year earlier at one of his lectures, and Millicent had been very enthusiastic about women's suffrage, saying she'd been told to pursue securing women's suffrage and her sister had been told to pursue medicine. The family from which Millicent came were known as astute political activists, and so he knew that with her, the minds of many could be persuaded into signing the important document. Mill asked for 100 signatures, but between everyone involved in the distribution of the petition, they managed to amass over 1,500 signatures of mainly women, but also men supportive of the suffrage movement. Even though the numbers seem small to us, that was a significant number back then, and the signatures spanned the length and breadth of the UK, including signatures from Scotland, Wales and Ireland, which at this point wasn't yet split into the North and the Republic. Once the petition was submitted via John, the hope was that it would be considered as a universal suffrage request, as it was looking like the right to vote was going to be awarded to those who owned property. Many women owned property themselves, and so they wanted to be included in this reform and make it equal and just. On the day the petition was brought into Westminster, it had to be covertly carried and left somewhere John could collect it. Emily Davies and Elizabeth Garrett hid the petition under the stall of an apple seller where he collected it and quietly amassed additional signatures from other MPs who were in favour of women's suffrage. This garnered a further 22 signatures. Just over a month later, John spoke to the Cabinet about the petition, but its official consideration and debate wouldn't be until 1867. The second reform bill was finally in motion, and Mill asked that the word man in the document be replaced with person. However, the legal loophole he was trying to enact got noticed straight away, and when a vote was called, he lost, but not by an enormous amount as he was suspecting. The split was 73 votes to 196, and even though this was a loss on his part, he was enthused by the amount of support he received and noted that it came from both sides of the House. Despite the petition not being successful at the time, the votes made on that day showed that the support in the House of Commons was more than they were expecting, and women seized the opportunity to use this leverage to their advantage. The cause in the late 1860s grew rapidly. In Manchester and the surrounding areas, a multitude of women's societies began popping up. Lydia Becker started the first one, the Manchester Women's Suffrage Committee, and their first meeting was in January of 1867. Lydia was lampooned in the press for doing so, and her best friend Jacob Bright, an aspiring MP, was also belittled in his campaign. But Jacob managed to secure his seat, and by 1868, he was the main supporter of women's suffrage in Parliament. Even his friends joked that he managed to find a way to weave the message into every single speech he gave, regardless if it was a related point or not. The first public meeting on women's suffrage was held in April of 1868 by the Manchester Society for Women's Suffrage. This group began a network of suffrage societies that would expand to over 500 individual groups by 1897, which would all fall under the same umbrella and with the same cause in mind. Millicent Fawcett began the National Union of Women's Societies in London, more commonly known as the Suffragists. This group operated with the goal in mind of bringing this expanding army of voices together under one umbrella to be as loud as possible. They embarked on a campaign of bombardment of the government. They wrote countless letters, sometimes several a day. They carried out marches, and awareness-raising public speeches were given from soapboxes to those who were most likely to join the movement, usually working-class women. The campaign of bombardment to the government by the suffragists was ignored. They did everything they could to get their voices heard in a civil manner. In 1868, Lydia Becker had radically managed to use a mistake that allowed around 1,000 women to vote in that year's election. When a woman in the Manchester Union realised she'd received a ballot paper with her name on it, she asked Lydia what she should do. Lydia told her she should definitely go along and see what happened, of course with her support. The pair turned up to the polling station and legitimately asked if the vote could be enacted, to which the polling master said yes. This loophole was quickly deployed across many women in the area who asked the local polling master to add their names to lists if they owned property, and so the 1,000 votes had to be counted, making it the first time women legally voted in an election. However, before this time, it hadn't actually been written in law that it was illegal for women to vote. That was written into the law in 1832, when it was ruled illegal for any woman to do so. But this legal loophole that the Manchester suffragists discovered was noticed and quickly sewn shut for the next election. The progression of women's societies bloomed over the next 20 years, and the campaign was at a turning point. In 1884, the Third Representation of the People Act was delivered by Parliament. This ignored the implementation again of female suffrage, but did level the playing field even further for more men, but it still didn't allow poorer members of society to vote. It extended the same voting qualifications that existed in towns to those who lived in the countryside, which had previously not been afforded the same rights. However, universal suffrage for both men and women still seemed like a long way off. With the Third Act yet again proving that the government wasn't keen at all to make it possible for the whole country to have a say on who was in charge, people began to realise that the only way to make a difference was to support the women in their lives and to assist in their plight. 2 years later, in 1886, a family who had been part of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Society in Manchester decided to move to London. They were the Pankhurst family, consisting of Richard, his wife Emmeline, and their daughters Sylvia, Christabel, and baby Adela. Emmeline and Richard were huge suffrage supporters. But as time passed, Emmeline had been growing increasingly impatient at the slow progress of the NUWSS, and she found Millicent to not be acting in a way that she found to be effective. This led Emmeline to have an idea. Maybe it was time to branch off and start a new women's suffrage group of her own, one which would change Westminster's views on nice, polite women and make them fearful of what was to happen next. However, the change to activities wouldn't be without sacrifice, and the women who were brave enough would have to be ready to give everything, even their lives. Next time on Macabre London, we'll be unpacking more in this mini suffragette series and delving into the stories of the WSPU and the move towards militancy. Was it something to be praised, or would the motto of deeds, not words, turn into something which hindered instead of helped, resulting in an event which would forever be known as Black Friday? Make sure you join me next time to find out. Some exciting news, so don't go anywhere yet. But firstly, thanks for joining me for this episode. I hope you're enjoying this mini series so far, just like I am. There's plenty more to come, and it just gets even more fascinating as we go. So make sure you're subscribed or following to keep up with the series. These episodes have taken weeks of writing and research so far, so if you want to help me out and to say thanks for the content, then I have a Patreon where you can find extra content too. If you haven't done so yet, head over to YouTube to take a look at these episodes. It really adds faces to names, and you get to see many of the people I talk about, plus me hosting the show as well. Now for the news. I am so very pleased and excited to say that Macabre London has been nominated for a True Crime Award in the category of Most Outstanding Indie Podcast. I'm so incredibly thankful for the team at the True Crime Awards and to the judging panel for listening to my show and for recognising the hard work that goes into it. I'm not asking you to do anything for that, but I thought I'd just share that lovely bit of news with you. And if you do fancy just helping me out by sharing episodes, following me on social media, and showing the team just how great our lovable ghoul gang is, then I'm sure that will all be useful, and a huge, huge thanks for your help. A big thanks to my amazing top-tier legendary executive Patreon producers, Christina, Christoph, Kate, Lisa, Mary, Ravel, Sally, Sam, Sarah, Terry, Teresa, V and Veronica, and all of our other patrons too. If you'd also like your name read out by me at the end of every episode or your name in the show notes, then signing up to Patreon is the way to make that happen. I hope to see you over there at patreon.com/macabrelondon so I can personally welcome you to the Ghoul Gang. Thanks for joining me for another macabre tale from London's past. I've been Nikki Druce. Remember to stay spooky, and I'll see you ghouls next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.